It's All Blues with an all-star cast. You must have recognized Miles Davis on trumpet, but also Bill Evans on piano, Wynton Kelly also on piano, Jimmy Cobb on drums, Paul Chambers bass, John Coltrane tenor sax, and Julian Cannonball Adderley on alto sax. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it is Wednesday, March the 6th. We are going to have open phones for the first half of the program today at 888-874-4888. The reason being, we didn't get a chance to talk with each other yesterday while I was busy trying to make some points. But I did get a lot of email from you and your reactions, and still, we should make some time to talk about things that are important to you. And so the first half of the program will be devoted to that. The second half of the program, we will be joined by a comrade of mine in the field of journalism, and he'll be talking about Hugo Chavez and the campaigns that he waged against poverty, particularly in Latin and Central America and in the Caribbean. So we look forward to that. He's going to tell us a very particular story as it relates to Haiti. 1-888-874-4888. Well, some things are still going on in Washington despite the coming storm. Today, Attorney General Eric Holder basically made himself available to the Senate Judiciary Committee, and they wanted to know about the Obama administration's policy on drones. This was a sticking point, and in fact, it still remains one with respect to the confirmation of John Brennan as CIA director and others. You may recall that there was a threat by the Republicans, and they made good on the threat to filibuster or to delay the broad vote from the Senate on Obama's nominees for various offices until they get answers. The situation, the Benghazi attack was one of them, and also we had this question of drones. So today, when Holder appeared before the Senate committee, he seemed to be taking a very conciliatory tone as opposed to the obstinate tone that the administration was said to have dealt with the Senate committee before. He had agreed now to sharing sensitive or secret information, not the redacted stuff that they decided to give the members of the committee. And they're handing over more information, ostensibly to comply with the promise by the president in his State of the Union address to be more transparent. So that was Eric Holder's job today, as he appeared before the committee wanting to know about drones and the constitutional questions relating to the killing of U.S. citizens, whether here or overseas, by extrajudicial beings, specifically with drones. So you may want to track that story later and see where it goes. But the Senate Judiciary Committee has basically forced some conciliation on the part of the Obama administration to comply with the historic relationship between Congress and especially the Senate Judiciary Committees and the President, the White House. Then we have Mr. Brennan, who still has not yet been cleared. He still hasn't. It looks like they want to give it to him, but he still does not have yet permission to be director of the CIA. He was cleared by the committee, but that was just the first step. Now comes the full step of getting the Senate as a whole to vote. But again, here too, the sticking point is about Benghazi and about the administration's use of drones. And hopefully they will be able to resolve that to somebody's satisfaction, because the clock is ticking. The administration has already begun its second term, and there are issues that need to be tended to urgently. So hopefully they'll make their intentions known, whether they're going to go forward with the confirmation or not. Hopefully we should know something by the end of the day today or tomorrow. Hopefully they don't have to leave early because of the snowstorm that's targeting Washington and the East Coast generally. In Maryland, the Maryland Senate has decided to repeal the state's death penalty, saying that it should not be in the business of killing people. So that vote took place today, and it is now up to the full House of Delegates to vote on the measure already approved by the Maryland Senate. And we have the Trayvon Martin case, where lawyers for the defendant, George Zimmerman, who shot dead the unarmed Trayvon Martin, they're making a different stance in their argument. They're no longer going with the stand your ground defense. They're now saying that they will take their chances and proceed with the case on the basis of the law as it applies to second-degree murder. And that, of course, it changes a whole bunch of things. They were expected in April to have their first hearing on the stand your ground defense. So they notified the courts that that would not be where they're going with this case. They will be arguing the case on the grounds of second-degree murder charges. All right. So those are some of the highlights I think would be interesting to follow up on. We'll see how it turns out. Michael from New Jersey, hello. You're on the air. And
hi,
welcome.
Therese. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
You know, on another program of yours, I mentioned in terms of a reaction to the sequester, that I thought that they would just let it happen, which they've done. And after using the media as a megaphone to prepare the public by frightening them and with dire consequences of the sequester, I thought that they would put forth a bill. And I see now that Obama's talking about a grand bargain again.
Yeah, well, the grand compromise or the grand bargain is basically permission to extend the time again before they have to make the second round of cuts. Don't forget, the sequester is really like the first round of cuts. And these cuts are not the painful cuts. They're cuts that are basically in budgets right now. And they can easily pare down
the 85 billion, you mean? Is that the 85 billion till the end of the year?
Yes.
Right.
They can make those cuts without too much of a hardship. But come March 27th, by then they ought to have some idea, both sides ought to have some idea as where the rest of the money is going to come from. And the thing is that the Republicans have basically cornered Obama. He's in a bad corner here. And they've done it very skillfully, but they've managed to have the upper hand on him. The fact is they both agree. As I said yesterday, the Democrats and the Republicans are exactly the same right now with respect to the budget and with respect to how to cure the deficit, which is cut, 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 especially those programs that they have in their crosshairs, cut those social programs, which means the vast majority of working people and unemployed people will be bearing a really hard burden.
Now, right, but if they do nothing, that those nobody has to make choices. They're just cut across the board, right?
Well, this is the issue. One of the things that is part of this grand bargain is to give the president the elastic that he needs to pick and choose where to cut.
So he becomes right, the bad guy.
Right, but here's the thing. The reason why we see no movement is because nobody wants to be first to announce the bad news that there will be painful cuts. Nobody wants to be the first to say that.
Well,
midterms elections are right around the corner.
Can I give another prediction, though?
Sure.
I think that they, both sides, I believe that they already have a bill prepared. I don't think that all this pressure is going to force them to write a bill and get a bargain and compromise. I think they already have something. It's probably crafted with the help of a group like ALEC, a secret group of corporate heads, financial elites. I believe it's already there, and I believe that from this point on, they're going to sell it to us.
I think you're absolutely on the money with that. You're absolutely correct. They've worked out something. The problem right now.
I believe it already exists, and that we're going to hear this. They're going to work up this bill, and it'll be something like the lead up to the war in Iraq. You know, they're going to say if we don't pass this, you know, the mushroom cloud, all this stuff is going to happen, and there'll be a lot of nasty stuff in that bill.
For poor people and
for middle class, and they're going to say, "Well, we have no choice." You know, they're going to threaten, frighten us, make stories up, and terrible future that will happen—the collapse of this and the collapse of that. And I think they've already crafted this bill, and they know what's in it. And I think that there's going to be, you know, thousands of pages in this bill. A rewriting of the tax code to broaden the base that they call that the middle class will take more responsibility, that we're going to pay more. And at any rate, I think the bill is going to be to the liking of those who pay for it, the wealthy and the powerful.
You have to take certain things into consideration. First and foremost, there is an approach that has been crafted, but nobody wants to show their hands. Because they know they have to say to Americans, look, you know.
They have to sell it to us.
It is really, really, really bad news. So when it comes, you know, they could bring it down from the really, really, really bad news to just tell people, you know, it's really bad. So they've taken two reallys out of the bad. And therefore, we could adjust to just one really bad as opposed to three really bad. Secondly, the president has lost momentum because the distraction, he has gone all over the country, he's doing all this, you know, the dog and pony show and whatnot, only because They're fighting for time. Nobody wants to be first to present the bad news. And the Republicans understand that perfectly. And that's why they're taking their time. They have nothing but an advantage to gain. They are intent on rebuilding the party, which they've done, and they've managed to, in the face of all of these cuts, which the Democrats are trying to use the time to pound the Republicans and turn people off. In fact, the exact opposite is happening. The Republican Party is coming together in a way that it hadn't before. Even the factions, the conservatives versus the really conservatives, they're coming together. And they have several strategic advantages over Obama. Obama now has a problem. His own party is beginning to murmur because they're seeing where this argument inevitably will go. It will mean a huge blow to the people who could least afford it. And he's going to have a riot on his hands because, don't forget, I keep reminding folks that Obama comes out of the old Democratic Leadership Council, the conservative arm of the party. Bill Clinton is his mentor and guide, it seems, because he's following the Clinton manual to the letter. And so he has to deal now with factionalism within the party. There are many liberal Democrats who are steamed at him for the kinds of things that he's getting ready to do, and he's not talking to them. So it's a reversal of fortunes. We just have to monitor it. Thank you, Michael, for calling. Hello, Rick from Ohio. Nice to meet you.
Hey, good to talk to you again.
Thank you.
Yeah, hey, I guess I could talk about the sequester.
You can talk about anything.
Yeah, and then you're saying that the party and the president, his party and the president are split. The Republicans are becoming more solidified and all of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, then I think that I don't, for one, to be honest, I don't think Obama is who he says he is. Or who everyone thinks he is, you know. And it seems sort of orchestrated to have Obama could nominate, for example, the most progressive people while signing into law or legislation the most horrendous things, and so then knowing that Republicans would prevent those nominations from going through, asking for an explanation, which is an automatic stalemate. That seems orchestrated to me.
I think you are absolutely correct, sir.
Yeah,
I think you hit the nail on the head. Please go on.
Yeah, and so I mean, there's like this, for me, there is a global narrative at hand. Because if you look at Chavez, the company, I think it was 2006, the election in Florida where the felons were weeded out, but people with similar names were also weeded out.
Oh, it's every election year. Every election, this happens where they purge the rolls, as they say, the voter rolls.
So that company, ChoicePoint, also stood under contract against Chavez in one of his elections. And so it's not just on U.S. soil. I mean, I just don't know where to begin. I understand for a fact that the crap that's coming out of Washington is groundless. And people are believing it in fear. And it is the NRA wants to give a gun to everyone, while at the same time, the shift of keeping things afloat in this country is being put further and further on the backs of poor people. That's groundless. That is complete. It will only make the planet hotter, sister. It will only screw this place up even further. You know.
Well,
I think
you put some very important pieces together, and I agree with your perspective on it. I think there is a dichotomy between what the president says and what the president does, and we're
right.
seeing it over and over and over again. And you know, in so many ways now, the narrative has become: is he telling us the truth? Do we know all we need to know? The people in the Senate are saying so. The people in the House are saying so. Business leaders are saying so. The voters are saying so. So his credibility is really now in question on a number of fronts.
Two or three months after a landslide election, which is bizarre. For example, if you look at in 2011, the Philippines, with Typhoon Kedrin, suffered the world's first trash slide. Now, the land where that trash was located was leased to the United States Foreign Aid Agency. Our foreign policy is horrible. It is literally, and it's literally killing people. And yet, you have these Christian fundamentalists. You know, they protect him from all kinds of real criticism. That's the problem. With their bogus claims of fascism or not fascism, but communism and Islam and, you know, Islamophobia and all of this, they are actually protecting him from true criticism. It is a total waste of time, and is technically, economically, it is an inflationary act. They're actually driving up the cost of being alive. It is completely insane. It is completely insane. You couldn't imagine. Oh my. Anyway, I just wanted to drive that with you. I certainly appreciate.
I'm getting from you that you're not too perturbed about this. I think you. I don't think you're perturbed enough, Rick.
it's
not coming
anywhere.
Through.
We are buying oil from Iran at the same time. Our U.S. government cannot afford oil. And so that's part of it collapsing, is not being able to afford the fuel. And so we're actually purchasing oil, gas from Iran. I mean, that is insane to me. That is totally insane to me. So at any rate, my sister, it is good to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Rick, for calling. Thanks a lot.
Take care.
Thanks. Well, you know, if you've been listening intently to these two calls, you get a sense that all the plans that have been made so far to confuse the people, well, they may not necessarily be working all that well, because people are beginning to connect the dots. And they're seeing beyond the shallowness of the arguments being made, because the assumption is that the public are idiots. We don't know anything, and we can't make sense of anything, and they're so smart and they're so capable, and it would be a shoo-in. It's all a matter of marketing. This is why I call the president the managed president. He is, a manufactured person. All of the effort being made with respect to how to market, and, you know, we talk about a landslide, but that is marketing. This last election was the costliest election on record in U.S. history. You know, billions spent. This is amazing. So when you get that kind of involvement in marketing, you could make just about anybody palatable. But at some point, if the person is not a genuine article, whatever the person presents, as opposed to what the marketing says he or she is, people will begin to determine that there is a difference. And they'll connect with that, that there is a difference. This wonderful, bright young man talking about hope and all of that is now busy dashing hope, because they're not letting us in on the secret. And in this regard, they are all playing the same game. They're all playing the same game. We'll take a break and come back and join our guest, who will tell us a bit about Hugo Chavez and the Caribbean right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. And I have the pleasure and privilege of introducing our guest to you. His name is Kim Ives. Kim writes for Haiti Liberté, the largest Haitian weekly newspaper with offices in New York and Haiti. Thanks, Kim, for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Eutrice.
Oh, not at all. Let me start by saying that, of course, you've been a very valued, and your paper have been a very valued presence in the community, not just for Haitians, but, of course, you serve largely the Haitian community. Mm-hmm. But it gives an insight to the Haitian view of the outside world as well, and you do that very capably. So I just want to give you some props there.
Well, thanks very much.
Of course, Hugo Chavez loomed large in the Caribbean, and of course, in the coverage that we've seen here, it mostly relates to the typical kind of, I would call it typical U.S. coverage of foreign governments, especially governments that they don't particularly like. It's a super simplification of the governments that you find this all the time with people who just believe that these scenarios that they encounter and the histories that they ought to know are very complex indeed. Mm-hmm. So could you tell us a bit from your perspective, how do you think Chavez, how do you rate the view or coverage of Chavez by mainstream media?
Yeah, it's interesting you should say that. I was driving around this morning distributing the paper. I mean, not distributing myself, but and listening to the radio. And it's funny because they had these commentators, pundits, if you will, BBC, NPR primarily. Don't go much further right on the dial than that. And here they were obviously having to nod to Chavez's immense impact and influence and the reverence with which the Venezuelan people view him. But they just had to dig up, unearth, find somewhere the people who would say that he was a monster, that he was and this meant going, of course, to places like Little Caracas or whatever it's called in South Florida, where the
in Doral.
Oh, yeah. Doral. Yeah, that's exactly mm-hmm. where they went, Doral. And interviewing some people there, and they were saying, oh, yes, we're so happy, and they were jubilant and reveling and honking their horns and having open houses and so forth. And I like the term that one of the pundits concocted, which was he was a democratic authoritarianism. I thought that was a particularly deft formulation. It's this, as you were sort of saying in your intro there, kind of a cartoon characters they make. And unfortunately, our North American public is often politically ignorant enough to accept a lot of these caricatures. And, of course, Hugo Chavez is one of those, that he was just this almost buffoonish blowhard who, you know, was doing nothing but throwing invectives at the U.S. and without much basis or knowledge even, and that nobody took him seriously. But as they say in Creole, Yap Con George, they'll get to know George. That is, I think, he was his influence went far beyond Venezuela. It went throughout Latin America.
I want to get into that a bit, but I just wanted to make this notation. It amazes me how the media continue to miss the picture. Going back to Doral, they will juxtapose a sea of people in Caracas, lots and lots of people crying and wailing,
right.
And they juxtapose that with the jubilance in Doral in South in Miami, and they never make the connection that the sea of people that you can clearly see with your own eyes, mm-hmm. vast majority of them are Afro-Venezuelans, mm-hmm. mestizos, people of color in Venezuela. Mm-hmm. And in Doral and places like that, or anybody that you see is anti-Chavez, they tend to be the upper crust.
Right.
And they never get that message, and they never translate what they're seeing. Why is it that this sea of people, thousands and thousands and thousands of people, who are crying and so forth, why is it that there's so much melanin on one side of the screen and there isn't so much melanin on the other side of the screen? And what does it mean that these people look so starkly different?
Right.
I missed that point, you know.
Yeah.
But tell us though about the story that you have written for this week's edition and what you felt compelled to share with the world.
Well, essentially, we could say the apotheosis of the Bolivarian Revolution happened on a spring day about 6 years ago, on March 12th, 2007, in Port-au-Prince. That is also Venezuelan Flag Day. And interesting, if you look at the Venezuelan flag, you'll see the Haitian flag is in it. You'll see the red and blue of the Haitian flag at the bottom with the yellow, at the top with the yellow. And that is essentially because Haiti was the touchstone for the revolutions in South America. In 1804, Haiti was the first independent nation of Latin America, the first black republic on the planet. And they provided the ships, the guns, the printing presses that Francisco de Miranda and Simón Bolívar, the great liberator, used to fight their anti-colonial struggle against Spain and liberate the continent. So Hugo Chávez traveled on that day, 6 years ago, to Port-au-Prince. And it was funny, at the time you had a president in power, a guy called René Préval, who was, once upon a time, he was called Aristide's twin, but they sort of parted ways because Préval very much bowed to the pressure from Washington to toe the line on many things, whether it's the ability for them to enter the airspace of Haiti whenever they want, or the territorial waters, or put in place neoliberal reforms. Préval went along with it, but, you know, he used to be a Marxist, militant, anti-devaluerist fighter, so he had this heritage of at least posturing something to the right, to the left, and so he received Hugo Chávez, and in addition, Hugo Chávez was bringing an incredible package of gifts, three power plants, improving the northern airport of Cape Haitien, supplying garbage trucks to pick up the trash, helping to support some thousand Cuban medical doctors who were deployed throughout the deep Haitian countryside. And, of course, the centerpiece of it was 14,000 barrels of oil a day. And this was through a program called Petrocaribe. So they didn't announce, Préval trying to more or less not piss off the U.S., didn't announce that Chavez was coming, and it was just at the last minute. And despite that, Yatrice, despite that, tens of thousands of Haitians poured out of the mountains, out of the streets, and onto the boulevard leading from the airport to the National Palace, where Preval's motorcade took Chavez, and they cheered, and they were, you know, pumping their fists and singing songs, etc., many dressed in red shirts and so forth. And what happened? Chavez had them stop the motorcade. He got out, and he started to jog along with the people. So in many ways, this moment in Haiti really captured the power and the dream of the Bolivarian Revolution that Chavez saw not just for Venezuela, but for the entire continent and indeed for all the people of Latin America. So that's really the story we start in the column that I wrote this week, where we see how this Petrocaribe program, he took this immense oil wealth, the world's greatest oil wealth in Venezuela, and began providing it to countries around the Caribbean and Central America. Today, this Petrocaribe deal, which essentially goes where a country pays 60% of the oil it receives, and the remaining 40% can be paid over 25 years at 1% interest. But now Venezuela is providing this package to 17 countries around Central America and the Caribbean, providing more than 250,000 barrels of oil a day. This is essentially providing the energy security, and we could even say the political and economic security of these countries. The program costs about $5 billion a year and really has created just a tremendous wellspring of support from the peoples of the region for Venezuela.
You mentioned in your column that this very program had so disturbed the United States, and that they were the innuendo is, if they could in any way break it or kill it, they would try to do so.
Mm-hmm. And they tried to mightily. And we had the privilege, Haiti Liberté had the privilege of receiving the documents, the WikiLeaks documents about Haiti back in 2011, before they all were released. Originally, just to remind people, WikiLeaks first went with the 250,000 secret diplomatic cables to basically big four papers, the Guardian, the New York Times, Der Spiegel, and Le Monde in France. And they really didn't do anything with them. You know, they published a tiny portion. As the New York Times boasted, they got permission from the U.S. government to do so. They heralded their servility. So essentially WikiLeaks said, let's go to the countries concerned. Let's go directly to Bolivia and Ecuador and Haiti. And they chose a press in the country that would be suitable, in this case Haiti Liberté, and they gave us those, and as we went through them, we saw this incredible story basically laid out by then U.S. Ambassador Janet Sanderson, who is now the deputy, one of the head chieftains, was one of Hillary Clinton's principal lieutenants in the State Department. I don't know what her post is now under Kerry. But essentially, they fought this discounted oil, which basically was meeting all of Haiti's power needs, a country which has been plagued by blackouts and power shortages for its whole history. They were fighting this tooth and nail and doing everything they could, getting together with the four main petroleum providers in the country. That was ExxonMobil, Texaco Chevron, the French outfit called ELF, and then there was one Haitian distributing outfit called Dinassa. And they tried to organize these four petroleum distributors to basically sabotage and undercut the Petro-Caribe deal. They even were making deals with Vicente Fox in Mexico to try to make a thing called the Program de Puebla or something, which would be a kind of sort of counterpoint to Petro-Caribe. That didn't go off, I think, because the Mexican oil oligarchs didn't go along with it. So they could never respond. And so anyway, this was really the story that we told back in 2011 using the WikiLeaks documents about Petro-Caribe in Haiti and the Caribbean.
So as you have the benefit of time now, looking back, and you have your own views, I'm sure. What do you think his greatest legacy has been, Hugo Chavez's?
Well, I think fundamentally wealth, or I could say riches are provided by energy. We know that from physics, matter and energy. But basically, if you don't have the power to turn on the light or to turn gas on your stove or to drive your car to the supermarket, you're crippled. And that is essentially the state of so much of the Third World and so much of Latin America. And Hugo Chavez, when he came into power, he said, I am going to give our wealth, our huge oil wealth, the greatest oil wealth on the planet, as it's recently been reconfirmed in the Orinoco Belt of Venezuela. We are going to give this to the people of Venezuela and to the people of the world. And so this was his legacy. He was a Robin Hood. He was taking from the hands of these rich oligarchs who had controlled it. And these aren't just Venezuelans, the ones who are now in Doral sitting toasting each other, but this included the U.S. Petro oligarchs too, in ExxonMobil, Texaco Chevron, et cetera. So, it used to be four companies, now it's two, right? Essentially were confronted by this upstart who was, as you noted early on, he was really a mixture of all the people. He was Indian, he had African, he had Caucasian, he had everybody in him, and he was the embodiment really of this 500-year process of resistance, which has been fought against the rape of the Americas by the original European conquistadors. And he was saying, no, we're trying to build something new. And he called it 21st century socialism. And really, I think that's the seed he has planted, and that will be his legacy in many ways. We can go around the streets these days and see still, people who don't even know what it is with a Che Guevara T-shirt on. He's become almost a fashion statement. But pretty soon that's going to be, I think, we're going to see more and more a Chavez T-shirt with the face of Chavez. He's become a symbol of that empowerment of Latin America.
And I want to thank you for joining me here today on Lead Stories. We will meet each other again tomorrow at the same time, and hopefully you will bring along a friend or two. We have to grow this audience. We have to grow PRN, and that is our job. So you can reach me at Lead Stories, LEID Stories at gmail.com. I'm also on Facebook.com/LeadStories, and Let's continue the conversation there, but help me grow this audience. Help us grow PRN.FM. Alternative Visions is next with Jack Rasmus, so you want to stay tuned for that. And you want to pay attention to how the story of Hugo Chavez is going to be presented to you. Again, it's so stark. I watch it every time, waiting for somebody to say, I wonder why it is that all these people over here, they're not white, and they love Chavez, and all the people over here are white, and they hate his guts. How did that come to be?
Yeah.
Nobody wants to tell that story about Venezuela. That is the story of Venezuela. In fact, this man was openly called El Mono, meaning the monkey. It was a racist, racist thing that he had to live through all of his life. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Calling the president that. But I want to thank you, and we'll see each other tomorrow again at PRN.FM. Pass the word. Help us build this audience. Goodbye.